Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. We'll hear the story of how a water restoration project at a farm on Spruce Creek came about and the difference it's made. But first, we'll talk with bird researcher and Pulitzer Prize-nominated author Scott Wydenstahl. The Eastern Pennsylvania-based writer was in town for Bookfest Pennsylvania and talked with WPSU's Emily Reddy about his best-known book, Living on the Wind, Across the Hemisphere with Migratory Birds. Scott Wydenstahl, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So scientists estimate that 5 billion birds migrate annually. I was surprised to read in your book that migration's not sparked by temperature or by hunger. I think most people would think birds say, hey, it's getting cold, or I can't find worms anymore, I better go south. But you say it's not that.
No, well, it's true that the change in the seasons drives migration, but the triggers that actually cause a bird to migrate are not hunger, because most birds are migrating when they're at their fattest, because they've laid on all this fat as fuel for their migration. And it's usually not temperature, because they're often migrating weeks or even months before it really gets cold. The trigger for migration, as most things in nature, is daylight. So as the days start to get shorter, as summer comes to an end, that triggers hormonal changes in the bird's body, and you get this little instinctive itch that grows into this overwhelming compulsion for the bird to take off into the night sky and start migrating.
I think a lot of non-birders would probably consider bird watching a dry topic, but you make it sound positively epic. In the preface of your book, you say, bird migration is the one truly unifying natural phenomenon in the world, stitching the continents together in a way that even the great weather systems, which roar out from the poles but fizzle at the equator, fail to do. What for you is the most compelling thing about bird migration?
Well, I think just that globe-girdling aspect of it. I mean, I live in Schuylkill County, out in the middle of farm country here, and every year the whole world comes through our backyard, because we have birds that spent the winter in the Amazon or Orinoco basins in South America or the islands of the Caribbean on their way to the Canadian Arctic or, Alaska, the Northwest Territories or Newfoundland or, the forests of Centre County. Some of them aren't going all that far. But all I have to do is walk outside in the morning with a pair of binoculars and see these global travelers. And if I go a little bit farther, we go to Alaska almost every year, birding and leading bird trips. And the birds that leave Alaska every year quite literally cover 3/4 of the Earth's surface in their migration. So you have birds like there's a species of shorebird called the bar-tailed godwit. It's about the size of a small pigeon. And these birds actually fly nonstop 7,200 miles from Alaska to New Zealand every year, and then make this huge looping migration in the spring from New Zealand up to the Yellow Sea in China and Korea, and then from there back to Alaska. So they're traveling something like 18,000 miles a year. And because these birds can live for 25 or 30 years, by the time a bar-tailed godwit dies, it will have flown the distance from here to the moon and most of the way back again.
I was surprised by that and by how complicated the navigation systems of birds are. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, even the lowliest house sparrow, it can sense aspects of the world that we're blind and deaf and dumb to. Most birds migrate after dark, and so they're using celestial orientation, which doesn't mean, like the old mariners, that they're using the constellations. They're not looking up and saying, okay, so the giant W is Cassiopeia, so that means I have to make a left here. They're aware of the apparent rotation of the stars around Polaris and the fact that the one part of the sky that doesn't appear to move is the north, and so that gives them their compass directions. But of course, if it's a cloudy night, they can't use celestial orientation, so they use magnetic orientation, where they tap in some fashion that we still have not fully understood, into the Earth's magnetic system, its magnetic field. Also, they can use ultra-low-frequency sound waves. Seabirds that travel across thousands of miles of ocean can actually smell their way back home the way salmon can. They can see polarized light that moves across the sky and kind of lockstep with the sun. So there's all these different cues that, as humans, we can't even begin to comprehend that even the most average bird can use.
And one of the ways that the knowledge of what birds do has really increased in the last 100 years or so is bird banding. What do we know because of bird banding that we didn't know before?
Well, the problem with watching birds is that they all pretty much look alike to us. One robin looks like any other robin. You know, there's this anonymity to birds. And so if you're going to study them, if they're going to study their movements, their migrations, their longevity, whether they come back to the same place in the summer, whether they come back to the same place in the winter, you have to have some way of marking them as individuals. And the simplest and most effective way of doing that is to put a small, lightweight, numbered leg band on the bird. And it's something that proportionately doesn't weigh any more on the bird's body than a man's wristwatch weighs on his. You put these numbered bands on, and then if the bird is ever encountered again, you start to connect the dots on where they've traveled, how long they've lived. It's been argued that almost everything concrete that we know about wild birds comes from marking them in some fashion, and especially bird banding them. I've been banding birds for, oh goodness, almost 30 years now, from eagles to hummingbirds. And it's an incredible feeling. First of all, it's an incredible feeling of privilege to be able to work with birds that closely and that intimately. But then when you get a recovery of a bird that you might have banded years and years earlier, and it turns up in some far-flung part of the world, it's an incredible, incredible feeling. And that's how, you know, a lot of migration science has advanced over the years. Now today we've got really remarkable new miniaturized technologies that are allowing us to track birds in real time. This past winter, I was involved with a project where we were putting GPS transmitters on snowy owls that had come down from the Arctic. And we were, in some cases, able to get precise three-dimensional GPS fixes as frequently as every 30 seconds to be able to track where these owls were traveling, what kind of habitats they were using, the kind of hunting behavior that they were employing, which is something we actually know almost nothing about for that species. So this is a really exciting time to be doing migration research.
And there are a lot of things, as you're doing your research, there are a lot of things that threaten migratory birds, like forest fragmentation is one of them. What do we know about how migratory birds are faring these days?
Well, we know that a lot of them are not faring particularly well. We've seen really dramatic decreases in the number of what are called neotropical migrant songbirds. These are birds that spend the summer up here in the northern latitudes but spend the winter in Latin America or the Caribbean. These are the most colorful birds, the birds people are really looking forward to seeing coming back to their backyards, wood thrushes and scarlet tanagers and rose-breasted grosbeaks and the like. And their numbers have dropped pretty significantly. I mean, wood thrush numbers drop about 4% every year, which is just statistical free fall. And part of that is because of habitat loss in the tropics. Part of it is because of the loss of what's called stopover habitat, the places that the birds need to rest and regain their energy and their strength on their migration. And a lot of it, as you say, is the loss of especially deep forest habitat here in the north. And that's a particular concern right now in Pennsylvania because so much of Pennsylvania is forested, and especially so much of northern Pennsylvania is, or at least until recently, was large unbroken blocks of forest. That's critical habitat for a lot of these birds because they're very sensitive to fragmentation. When you chop forests up into smaller pieces, that allows in edge predators like raccoons and skunks and possums and black rat snakes and blue jays that prey on their nests. It brings in an avian parasite, the brown-headed cowbird, that finds the nests of these birds and throws out their eggs and lays its own eggs in their place. It brings in alien predators like house cats. And so as we've been seeing the natural gas boom sweep across Pennsylvania, the areas of greatest impact from fracking have been the areas, it almost perfectly overlaps the areas with the largest intact forest. And so as the state has been auctioning off more and more state forest land and other state-held lands for natural gas development, it is a real problem for a lot of these migratory birds because Pennsylvania has a conservation responsibility for species like scarlet tanagers and wood thrushes because such a large percentage of their global population breeds in Pennsylvania.
In your book, you quote a biologist named J.P. Myers saying we might see the end of migrations in our lifetime, but you say you're still optimistic in the book. You wrote this in 1999. Bring us up to date. How do you feel now?
Well, I think by nature I'm an optimist, if only because there's not a whole lot of percentage in pessimism. If you get pessimistic, you just want to go jump off a bridge. It's been a mixed bag. I mean, there's been since I wrote the book in 1999, we've understood a great deal more about migration. We have a much better sense of what we have to do to preserve migratory birds. We're taking much more of an international approach because you can't defend these birds just within borders because they pay no attention to international borders. The thing that has most migratory bird conservationists the most concerned, I think, is climate change, because it's so pervasive and it's particularly damaging to those birds with the most dramatic and most epic migrations. I mentioned the bar-tailed godwit traveling 7,200 miles across the Pacific Ocean. It can only do that because of predictable weather patterns, predictable wind patterns, predictable food supplies so that it can bulk up in a relatively short period of time before it makes these migrations. And as the climate changes, all of those variables start to go out the window. Weather patterns change. Food supplies become more erratic. One of the real concerns right now is that as the climate warms, the forests leaf out earlier and earlier in the spring. The insects on which the birds depend appear earlier and earlier in the spring. But the birds are not migrating based on the temperature. They're migrating, especially those that are coming up from Central and South America, they're leaving based on an internal clock that is genetically programmed. And when you look at the records going back, in some cases, up to 100 years, those birds are returning every year, on average, exactly the same time that they did almost a century ago. And yet, increasingly we're seeing the forests leaf out earlier and earlier and the insects appear earlier and earlier. So there's a growing disjunct, a growing disconnect between when the birds are appearing here and when their food is available. And so not so much in the Western Hemisphere, we haven't really seen this here yet, but in the Old World involving trans-Saharan migrants coming from Africa up into Europe, there have been some really dramatic collapses in the populations of species like pied flycatchers because of that seasonal disconnect that's starting to kick in. So, yeah, I'm still an optimist, but I'm an increasingly worried optimist.
And your most recent book isn't about birds. It's called The First Frontier, The Forgotten History of Struggle, Savagery, and Endurance in Early America. What's that about?
That's a history of the early colonial frontier here in the East. And it strikes people sometimes as an odd switch for somebody who's always written about natural history. But I've always been fascinated by the early colonial history here in the East, in part because, God, I'm a naturalist. I would love to have seen that early frontier when we had flocks of billions of passenger pigeons flying overhead. I mean, when the East was the wild, untamed frontier, at least from a European perspective. And it's a history that really isn't very well taught in school, that most of us know very little about. And so it was what was supposed to be a 2-year project ended up being a 6-year immersion in that period of history. So it was a lot of fun to do.
Scott Weidenthal, thank you for talking with me.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was WPSU's Emily Reddy talking with Scott Weidenthal, the author of Living on the Wind, Across the Hemisphere with Migratory Birds. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction Writing. Next on Take Note, we'll tell you about a recently completed stream restoration project at the Rothwell Farm in Center County. Landowner Sally Rothwell and Clearwater Conservancy's wildlife biologist Katie Ombalski say the improvements impact water quality all the way to the Chesapeake Bay.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
As Trout Unlimited puts it, streams are the lifeblood of the land. They are the veins in the arteries that carry the substance, water, that all life depends on. Katie, explain to us what constitutes a healthy stream. And why is it important?
locally, the most important aspect of our streams is that they're tied directly with our groundwater. So if the water quality of the surface streams is polluted, likely it will also affect our drinking water. So we have to really think about when we have activities on the land, such as agriculture, what kind of pollutants we're allowing to get into the streams.
I was surprised to read that in 2004, the US EPA reported to Congress that 44% of streams in the U.S. are not clean enough for swimming or fishing.
It's staggering. It's really staggering. And locally, with the amount of agriculture that we have, which is really important to our local economy, but we also have to make sure that while we are undertaking these agricultural activities, that we aren't jeopardizing the most important thing to all of us, which is clean water.
So here you are, Sally. You purchased this farmette in Ferguson Township in 2010, and you contact the Clearwater Conservancy to get advice on how to improve the quality of your stream, one of the most well-known streams in central Pennsylvania, Spruce Creek. Tell us a little bit about this farm you bought.
Well, it's a 36-acre farm in Pine Grove Mills. The stream is really, really nice, and the only thing, the surrounding area is full of garbage, old tires. You won't believe people dump things there. They never take their trash to the...
So you had an illegal dump on your property?
Yes. The owner themselves did it, and it's an accumulation of maybe 100 years. I'm not exaggerating. It took us more than 1 year to clean up the whole place.
So Sally calls your office, Katie, and what is it about her property that interests you?
Well, her property is located at the headwaters of Spruce Creek, right below Rock Springs that Penn State University owns. And when you think about water quality and how to protect it, what you want to do is start in the headwaters and work your way downstream, because everything that happens upstream of you affects the water quality as it moves through the watershed. So we are really in the headwaters of the Chesapeake Bay. Everything we do here can affect water quality all the way to the bay and at the bay. So when Sally called and said, I just purchased 36-acre property in the headwaters of Spruce Creek and I want to do a stream restoration project, tell me how I can protect and improve this long length of stream, because she owns over half a mile of stream, we were very excited to help her do that.
What were your goals, Sally? What did you want to do?
Just clean water, you know, potable and drinkable, pure water. My history is from the Philippines. We have a river that's really polluted, and I don't want that to happen here. To me, water is the basic of human life.
What Sally, the way her property is managed is that about two-thirds of the land is managed under agriculture along the stream, and then the downstream third is her yard. And so the contaminants that get into the stream are directly tied to the land use. So if we were able to improve her agricultural practices and buffer and protect the runoff that would be coming off those fields from getting into the stream, we're going to be reducing sediment and nutrients from getting into the water, nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus. Those three things, sediment, nitrogen, and phosphorus, are the three big polluters in the Chesapeake Bay.
And so what you set out to do is create what you call a protective riparian buffer.
Correct.
Explain exactly what that is.
In Pennsylvania and much of the Northeast, the natural condition of a stream is to be forested. And the reason that that's so important is because the roots from shrubs and trees anchor the stream banks and keep them very stable. So you don't have a lot of, you know, although streams naturally move sediment, it's in a constant balance. And what happens is when we remove those trees and shrubs, we upset that balance, and lots of sediment can get into a stream, but it also can start eroding and really moving at a very unnatural rate.
Trout Unlimited's slogan is "Return the roots, runoff pollutes." And I think so many of us who are property owners along stream sides, we think that we are improving the property when we clear out the shrubs and we chop down the trees and we make what we think is easy access for fishermen. We're unwittingly doing the absolute wrong thing, aren't we, Katie?
Absolutely. Yep. It's the worst thing that you can do. And the irony is that really anybody who has a stream on their properties thrilled to be able to have it, and they want to do the right thing, they want to protect it, and like you said, they're going in the opposite direction from meeting their goals. The challenge is that everybody really wants to see the stream, and so really what you want to do is to be able to open up small openings and gaps so that you can enjoy that as a landowner, but by and large, you want to have the banks forested.
So let's get back to Sally. Tell us a little bit about what you undertook. How long did it take, and what sort of effort was involved in restoring your stream to its original health?
Well, in the beginning, I was doing it myself, and I was trying to clean it up. And when Katie saw me, she said, oh, no, don't do that. And And it was just so funny. I was doing things that I was not supposed to do.
For instance, removing trees
the branches,
and fallen limbs.
Yes, I thought those limbs are blocking the stream. So we were cutting it down, and Katie stopped me right away. She said, don't, we need that. It's amazing. It's amazing what they do.
Katie, what kinds of plants and shrubs will you plant? And I ask that because I know that stopping invasive species is a critical problem along stream beds throughout the state.
Yes, we plant all native trees and shrubs. They have to be specific to riparian areas. Things we planted at Sally's included trees like sycamore and pin oak and red oak. We also plant things that tend to grow faster because the faster the buffer gets established, the better it is, less work it is for maintenance. But things like aspen and silver maple, tulip poplar. We also plant lots of shrubs like silky dogwood, common elderberry, ninebark. These are all things that are native to the area. Some of them, we actually have volunteers that help grow these things through our Growing Native program. It's all about getting native species back on the stream banks. And the reason that's important, when the native plant material falls into the stream, the twigs and the leaves and the big branches, it's the beginning of the food chain. The insects that live in the stream, they've evolved with these species and they recognize them as food. But when invasive species fall into the stream, they don't recognize them as food. Might as well be, you know, a fishing lure or a can or something that's just not edible. And so it really starts to break the food chain right away when invasive species are present. So that's a big effort in making sure that we remove as many as we can and are constantly trying to increase the density of natives.
Sally mentioned partners, so it was not just Clearwater
that's
Conservancy
right.
working on its own. Who else would be involved and why would they be interested in a project like Sally's?
For all projects, we always try to bring in partners and we all have different skill sets and different resources. And so we try to bring everybody together to make the projects efficient and done as well as possible. In Sally's case, we worked with the Farm Service Agency, which manages a federal program called CREP, or Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, and they help plant buffers on farms primarily.
And farms are one of the biggest culprits in terms of spoiling streams.
That's right. And I think a lot of it's unintentional. And, you know, farms were developed before we really had a working knowledge of what it takes to protect a stream and how important it is to maintain forested buffers to keep sediment and nutrients out of streams. The critical thing is putting it back. And as Sally said, the effort that it takes is really way more than one person can handle. And so bringing organizations like Clearwater Conservancy in really helps. We have lots of volunteers. We have technical expertise. We have access to public and private funding to help find the resources to do these things that are for the community good.
In fact, a small army of volunteers who are trained in riparian stewardship showed up on your property.
Yes, and they're just so dedicated too. I mean, they're not getting paid and they're there on their day off pulling weeds around the trees that they planted, putting the trees back where it should be. So many things.
Lots of people call our organization and say, I want to help, I want to contribute, I want to participate or volunteer in some way. And as we've done so many of these riparian restoration projects, what we've realized is that we need a lot of help because we don't have the resources to pay contractors to do all of this work. And we really want to have people engaged. And so what we recognized was the opportunity to take a volunteer and assign them to one specific property. So they are then the site steward of that property, and they're the liaison with the landowner. And if they need a lot of help, then we can get work groups to help them do the follow-up maintenance. But one of the things we always tell our landowners is that once we have this project on the ground, we're not going to abandon you, and this is all for you to take care of. And in theory, it would be great if you could, but we know the reality is that you'll need assistance.
Lots of people may recognize that they have problems with their own stream, but be reluctant to do it because of the cost involved. What did this project cost you?
Very little. In fact, the state or the federal government pays me some rent money to keep this going. And Katie has more the numbers because they were the one who spent a lot of money on restoring the property.
So why would the state be so interested in Sally Rothwell's project in Ferguson Township?
The short answer is easy. It's about clean water. But the more detailed answer is, really this is coming from the federal government and the state government because Sally's enrolled in a Farm Bill program called the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. We call it CREP for short. And basically it's a rental program. The federal government, in partnership with the state, will lease land, usually somewhere between 10 and 15 years. It's up to the landowner. These are voluntary programs. And the idea is that they want to retire lands that really shouldn't be farmed. They have soils that either are unstable, they're highly erodible, or they're in sensitive areas like right next to a stream. If the landowner qualifies, then they can enroll in this rental program. And it will help pay to get the practice installed. We call these practices, which would be a buffer. Sometimes it'll help with fencing or crossings, some other larger agricultural best management practices too. But then the landowner, if they're retiring acreage, they can actually get a rental rate somewhere in the range of about $150 to $160 a year for that term that they've agreed to.
And so there's no longer farming going on at the Rothwell Farm?
Yes, partly.
Yeah, not along the stream.
Yes.
Sally, last year, I believe it was, some 60 people took a tour of your restoration project, and one of the most common responses there was that the erosion control measures and the fish habitat structures that you built blended into the natural background so well that they actually couldn't tell that anything had been done. It just looked like it had always been that beautiful.
Well, aside from those, Katie spread wildflowers in the place, and I was always telling her about killing the weeds. And Katie said, no, those are not weeds. Those are wildflowers. So, I mean, her knowledge is amazing. And those people that went there, they were really impressed.
Can you give us kind of a snapshot of the before and after of what the Rothwell Farmette looks like today?
Well, I wish I have a picture to show you. If you go to a dump place, those garbage place where we take our garbage, that's how it looked like. There were several places, like close to the stream, close to the house. There were piles of junk, really junk. I wish I can show it in the picture, the before and after. It's amazing. Now it's like a respite area for human being, and it's just so relaxing to see it. It's natural habitat.
And what impact will this project have on drinking water for all of us?
Well, what was really great about her project is that she wanted the buffer to be as wide as we could plant. So she has areas that are up to 180 feet wide. It's the widest buffer we've ever planted. And upstream from her property, the farming activity still occurs, but the sediment and the nutrients that are applied to the land aren't getting into Spruce Creek, which then in turn is tied intimately with our groundwater. So nitrogen, which is not something you want to have in your drinking water at high levels, on her property anyway, is not getting into the well water, basically, of people downstream from her.
Has this project sparked interest among other streamside property owners in the area?
It has. And when you talked about feeling like this is just one little piece in the big picture when you think about the Chesapeake Bay, but what happens is once we start working on a stream, and when we had that tour back in August, somebody just downstream from her said, that was great, and I want to see that happen on my property. In fact, I'm meeting with him tomorrow.
How many of these kinds of projects can an organization like Clearwater Conservancy take on in a year?
Well, it really depends on the partners that we're working with. If we enroll a lot of the landowners in CREP, then we know we're working with partners, the Farm Service Agency and the Chesapeake Bay Program and the state of Pennsylvania. We also work with the Center County Conservation District often, or other county districts. We also have private funding. So depending on how our partnerships come together and the funding sources, it really depends. But we've done anywhere in between 1 and 10.
And is the way it worked in this situation typical? And what I mean by that, Sally Rothwell came to Clearwater Conservancy, or is it typically the other way, where you go to a landowner and say, you've got this valuable stream that's in jeopardy?
It actually goes both ways. And one of the reasons I love my job is because it's all voluntary. So when we go to a landowner, we're going there not as a regulator, but as somebody who says, we recognize the value of your stream and you might need some help. Lots of times we get phone calls from landowners. In Sally's example, she just bought this property and knew there was lots of room for improvement. And or other people will see a project we've done and say, I want to do that on my property.
All right. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thanks for
having
us.
That was Clearwater Conservancy's wildlife biologist Katie Ombalski and landowner Sally Rothwell of Rothwell Farm in Center County. For WPSU's Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.